So, before I start to clarify, mobile GPUs, what we mean is the GPUs inside smartphones and tablets. How many of you own a smartphone / tablet? Everyone? No? I still got one of these guys, so I don't even think it has a GPU. We'll be talking a lot about those today. Okay. So, first I want to start off with what exactly are SoCs, and these are the devices that are inside cell phones and tablets, and we'll go into a few specific ones. We'll talk about NVIDIA's Tegra 2 and Tegra 3, and then probably the most popular series right now, the PowerVR SGX. And let's talk a little bit further about the new iPad and how that changes things with regards to graphics. Then a little bit about the future. One point that I wanted to make was that it was really hard to find official data just talking about different GPU architectures or how different things work in the mobile scene. They're very opaque. So a lot of the data that I have are from different news articles and review sites around the web. And I think the information is all good, so we'll go with that. Okay. So first off, I want to talk about what is an SoC. And what I mean by SoC is a system on a chip. So we're essentially trying to fit all of the different compute components involved in the making of a computer onto a single die. So these components include the CPU, the GPU, a DSP whenever you're doing audio or video processing, which is very common on the cell phone, and I/O components. For a computer, this would be like the SATA port that you connect to your hard drive. Or for a smartphone or tablet, this is the flash controller or the SD card controller. The top vendors right now for SoC are Qualcomm. Anybody know if they have a Qualcomm chip inside their phone? Typically, if you have something like an HTC Android phone, you'll probably have Qualcomm inside. Apple, of course, makes their own chips for their products. TI is also a big vendor. Samsung makes the chips inside their phones, some of them. And NVIDIA is actually a very new player. And I thought this market share diagram was actually really interesting. So you can see here that Apple, which only makes chips for its own devices and nobody else, has 23% of the market share. So you can see how many iOS devices are actually selling. Qualcomm is the big leader right now at 31%. Can anyone think of some advantages as to why you'd use an SoC and why they're the kinds of things as opposed to using discrete components in a smartphone or tablet?
SoC is much smaller since it's all on one chip.
Right. One thing we're going to talk about is how putting interconnect between components that are not on the same die can cause a lot of power expense. So putting everything together makes things a lot cheaper in terms of the energy front. How about any disadvantages? Exactly. So once you put the device together, you're stuck with it. And even from, say, a manufacturer's standpoint, once HTC goes Qualcomm, that means they get the whole deal, the CPU and the GPU. You can't mix and match. So the SoC vendor has a lot more control about what happens inside a device as opposed to the actual manufacturer itself. Once they go with a company, they're going to stick with it for a while, and they're going to use those same chips. What we're actually going to see is not only smartphones and tablets, but also probably laptop PCs also switch to SoCs. So I believe the next generation of Intel chips, the Haswell architecture, will actually integrate a SATA controller on die. So we're going to see a lot more things just converge to a single chip. That way, the people who are making the chips have more control. Okay, to go further into what is an SoC, this is a piece of a logic board on an iPhone 4S. And this covers just a little rim on the top. So this is probably like a few inches wide and a couple of inches tall. And from there, you can see the different chips. And this is pretty much all of the components inside an iPhone 4S, any kind of IC. Everything else is taken up by batteries and screen. So this big red square in the center is the A5 SoC. So this device contains the CPU and the GPU. And interestingly enough, another way to even save space is to do what's called a package-on-package architecture, where you stack the RAM on top of the device itself. So you have the CPU and GPU on one die, and then you just put the RAM on top and you make the connections 3D. And that way, you can save even more area. The other chips around here are for radio and RF, so you need different kinds of power amplifiers, filters, and of course transceivers to actually can do the reception. Okay. If we look at a block diagram of an SoC, so TI makes the OMAP line. The OMAP 4460 is the device inside the Galaxy Nexus, and this is a slightly higher clock version of that. So these are all the different components that are inside an SoC, and you can see there are quite a few. The big ones I want to point out are we have a dual-core processor here, so we have two cores, Cortex-A9. We have a PowerVR GPU, and other things that we have are a video accelerator here. So instead of actually using the CPU or the GPU, we have custom hardware to do our video decoder, and that way we can save even more energy. We also have a custom hardware to do image processing. So whenever we take a picture, how do we encode that into different formats? Again, another way to take a little more area to create for putting new hardware on the die, but as a result, we get better energy consumption. Other things, you see a memory controller. You also see, if you go around, we have the USB controllers, RAM controllers, flash memory controllers, even things for a keypad, connecting for a touchscreen controller, HDMI, almost every kind of connection that you can imagine, all in a single chip. And that's the idea behind it. While the focus of today is focused on GPUs, it's very important to at least mention ARM. So ARM is a fabless designer, and their job is to create CPU designs. So the common designs you see today are the Cortex A8, A9, and A15, and those are the different generations. So the A8 is what you'd see inside an iPhone 4. The A9 is what you see inside the 4S, and that's an out-of-order version that can also support multiple cores. The A15 is going to be the newest generation, and you'll see that in the latter half of the year. And that's a much wider CPU core, so we'll see a lot higher performance out of designs like these later in the year. And again, what I mean by fabless designer is that they do not manufacture their own chips. They simply have engineers who design the chips, and then they sell the designs to the different SoC vendors. So for example, TI licenses a Cortex A9 design that you saw, and then actually makes it for that OMAP chip that would go inside a Galaxy Nexus. There are two different kinds of licensees that I should point out. One is the one like TI, where they just buy the design and integrate it into their own chip. Another is an architecture licensee. And what that means is that they have free license to do whatever they want to the core, or design their own completely new one. So Qualcomm is one company that does that, and that gives them a competitive edge of sorts. So they don't operate on the same timetable as everybody else, because TI and Samsung right now, for instance, are waiting for A15 designs to be ready. So they're both going to be releasing chips really together in the second half of the year. Meanwhile, Qualcomm, they don't have an A15 chip, but they have an A15 class processor that's already out and shipping in phones just actually a couple weeks ago. So it offers similar performance, but now they're 6 months ahead of everybody else, at the cost of earlier on in the game that they might have lost performance because their designs weren't new. They actually didn't have an A9 class CPU. Any questions about anything so far? Okay. So before we talk about mobile GPUs, we should talk about what makes these different from our typical desktop class GPUs. And the big thing, in my opinion, is energy. So we all have cell phones and tablets, and we want them to have high battery life. So if a typical cell phone battery capacity has 5 to 7 watt-hours of energy storage available to it, how long or how much energy should our chips consume in terms of watts? What's the battery life that you guys expect out of your phone, say, in a typical usage case? Any takers?
At least a day.
At least a day. So what would that be, like 10 hours of real-world usage? So then, with that kind of constraint, our entire device has to consume around 500 milliwatts of energy. And when I mean entire device now, we have the CPU, the GPU, the rest of the SoC, and perhaps more importantly, the screen and the cell radio, which of course have to be the cell radio has to consume a lot of power because it's talking with a radio tower 40 miles away. And your screen, of course, especially phones these days with larger and larger screens, are going to consume even more power. So you're going to see screens consume perhaps the watt range, while the SoC itself might be a few hundred milliwatts. As a comparison, does anybody know like the typical max power dissipation for a GPU or CPUs that you see in desktops and laptops? Yeah, so top of the line GPUs can hit 250. I think even these the parts where you have two GPUs on the same PCB, like the GTX 590 or so, they can consume up to 275, 300 watts. Your CPUs, the ones inside your laptops, are 35 watt max. So this is well over an order of magnitude in difference in performance and power consumption. On the area front, as Carl mentioned earlier, we have PCB size constraints. You saw how small the iPhone 4S logic board was. So that's all the space we have to fit a chip. And on top of that, we also have cooling constraints. We can't just slap a fan in our cell phone and use that to cool the device because, one, nobody wants to hear a fan. Two, we don't have any space for a fan. And three, a fan consumes even more energy because we have to spin that up. So everything inside a cell phone or a tablet has to be passively cooled. And that really limits the amount of energy that we can consume and the thermal dissipation of the chip. Any questions? So I thought this was cool. I have some energy numbers for iPhone 4 and iPhone 4S on doing different tasks. So if you're using like a maps application or browsing the internet, you can see around a 1 watt power consumption. And I think this is around a medium brightness level. You start gaming on these devices, jumps to 2 watts power consumption. And even more interesting, perhaps, is the gulf between the iPhone 4 and a 4S, where a 4S has a dramatically more powerful GPU. So you can see the power consumption kind of similar when doing more simplistic tasks, especially like idling or launching a web browser. As soon as you jump to games, you're seeing a 0.2 to a 0.4 difference in power consumption. So you can see the emphasis on trying to keep idle power as low as possible, but whenever time for performance comes, you want to be able to get the most out of your device. So we should talk about some of the contributions that make energy consumption very large. And these are a couple of things that I wanted to point out that is very important to consider in mobile devices as opposed to desktop devices or laptop devices. And one of them is off-chip interconnect. And that's the reason why we want to integrate things. Whenever you want to take data from one chip to another chip that are on part of the PCB, you have to drive lines. And on those lines are going to be, if you took like introductory circuit courses, there's a lot of resistance, capacitance, and even inductance on those lines. And to really get that data across, you're going to have to use a lot of current. And when you have a lot of current, you're going to use a lot of energy. So the reason why making large interconnect is twofold. One is we don't have to want to put a lot of wires down, because one that consumes a lot more area and then a lot more energy. So we want to limit the amount of bandwidth that we have. Another reason is the more times you fire up the bus, the more times you're going to use energy. So minimize the amount of traffic that you have between two chips. Another thing to point out is high frequencies also contribute to high switching energy. And this is simply the more time your chip cycles, the more times your transistors are switching, the more energy you consume. So you see mobile devices, for instance, have a lot lower clock speed than, say, the GPUs and CPUs and laptops and desktops. So if we talk about theoretical performance numbers for some devices, here are two popular tablets of a few months back, and in comparison is a nice top-of-the-line desktop these days. So you see the CPUs themselves clock at around 1 gigahertz. Tegra 3 is really pushing it at like 1.4. Your CPU inside your desktop is at least 3 gigahertz probably. GPU clocks, you can also see a big difference, although they're not as much. And GPU manufacturers tend to widen things instead of making things go faster. Memory interfaces, you can also see a big difference. So the iPad 2 is pushing things at 64-bit memory interface, whereas a nice desktop GPU has 256-bit bandwidth. And at one point, these things were even at 384 or 512. And you can see the big difference in compute performance as a result of these low clock speeds and smaller devices themselves. So an iPad 2 GPU, which is really one of the top GPUs out there, can provide 16 gigaflops, while a Kepler card can do 3 teraflops. And these are the constraints that we're dealing with, energy and area. All right, any questions? Okay. So now we're going to delve into the GPUs themselves inside the mobile devices. And the first one I wanted to talk about was the Tegra 2. So the Tegra 2 is a kind of a typical immediate mode rendering architecture. And I'd like to say it's a bit reminiscent of the G4.6, which you might have seen in Patrick's earlier lectures on graphics pipelines. And so what I mean by that more importantly, is that there are separate pixel shaders and vertex shaders. So the technology is a little older in a sense. We don't have unified shading. So you can see here, we also have a unified memory because the memory is shared between the CPU and the GPU, where we store our vertex buffer objects, a frame buffer, and textures. We have different caches to store these data. We'll talk about that a little later. And then you just have the regular steps of the pipeline. Your vertex processing, your primitive assembly, your rasterization, shading, and then clipping and running back to the frame buffer. So, as I mentioned in the previous slide, we have separate vertex and pixel shaders. In the Tegra 2, we have 4 of each. So, each one of these is a scalar-wide device, so it can perform one floating point operation. One interesting note is that, so this is a feature that actually debuted in later GPUs like the G80 and afterwards, was caching for things like pixels and vertices and attributes. And the reason for this is what we were saying earlier. We want to minimize the amount of bus transfers that happen to another chip, even when you're on the same SoC itself. So by caching things that will be used frequently, like say pixel caching for UI, then we don't have to fire up a bus to talk to another chip. We have the data locally, which not only can improve performance, but perhaps more importantly, consume less energy. Other things that they talk about in a white paper on this device is memory controller optimizations. So when you have one memory controller for both the CPU and the GPU, how do you control access? How do you not starve one or the other? And another thing is, how do you minimize the number of memory banks that you have enabled so that you can minimize energy and still have the performance necessary to serve all the requests? When we talk about now a Tegra 3 device, which is something that came out early in the last few months, we actually see that they're still stuck to a split pixel and vertex shader architecture. But now we have 8 pixel shaders instead of 4, and we kept the vertex shader count the same. Any thoughts on about why NVIDIA would do this? Of course, using a unified shader architecture is probably more optimal in every sense, but assuming they didn't have the resources to pull that off, why would you increase the pixel shader count?
Well, in my experience, the vertex shader doesn't change as much.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Like, the input is usually the same, the output is usually the same. Most of the hardcore computation goes to the pixel shader.
Mm-hmm. So you see probably in a lot of games that geometry itself, especially on perhaps mobile games, the amount of geometry that they're doing is not increasing nearly as much as the pixel count on some of these devices. So especially when we talk about the new iPad, it has more resolution than almost all laptop displays, really. So when we consider that, having pixel shaders to not only drive the frame buffer for all of these pixels, but the fact that there might even be more fragments computed for different games as opposed to geometry shows why you would increase the pixel shader count. Another interesting note is this 4+1 architecture that they have. And so I should say that the Tegra 3 is a quad-core device, but these golden rectangles that you see there actually show 5 different cores on this. And what NVIDIA did was they used 2 different kinds of transistors when developing this die. They used more higher performance transistors for the 4 main cores and used low performance but also low energy transistors for the 5th core. So the idea is that whenever your device is idling or standby, and its only job is to really receive your push notifications, let's just use a smaller core, but a single core that consumes less energy for those tasks. And then whenever you're playing your Infinity Blade or other games, then we fire up these 4 cores and can give you the performance that you want. So here's a really good example of a trade-off between area and energy. If we have extra space on our PCB and we can be more economical, we can put more stuff on the die in order to save energy. Batteries are not very much increasing in size, but battery life expectations are. So we have to think of clever ways to optimize for energy in these cases. Okay. Now I want to talk about the PowerVR architecture. And this is fundamentally different from the immediate mode renderers you've seen both in the Tegra and also GPUs like AMD and NVIDIA GPUs you see in desktops and laptops. And the reason is because the Power VR does something called tile-based deferred rendering, which I think Patrick is going to talk about more in the mobile graphics lecture next. But the basic idea is that first you perform your vertex computations and you do all and your primitive assembly. So you have your set of triangles and you keep that as scene data. What you do next is use this tiling accelerator to split up the primitives into tiles, organize them where they would be. Then what happens is once you have all of the tile, all of the triangles for a tile, then you perform hidden surface removal and Z testing that way. So in a normal immediate mode pipeline with early Z, you can only remove fragments that aren't going to be shaded if they are given in a certain order. Otherwise, if they're not, you're going to have to keep a bunch of them, and that's the limitation of early Z. And you have to wait until the end of the pipeline for the Z test in order to remove all of the fragments. Here, since we know all of the triangles for a given tile, then we can actually do full hidden surface removal and have zero overdraw whenever we're drawing a tile. And why would this be especially important for mobile architectures? To limit the amount of overdraw as much as possible. Yeah, that's definitely one concern. Yeah, energy. What at a lower level would overdraw use, perhaps? Drawing for something. I don't know if I'm specific enough. So whenever we do pixel shading, we have to load textures and we have to load pixel data, which consume a lot of bandwidth. So as I said before earlier, that mobile GPUs, bandwidth is extremely precious. And in terms of energy, we want to limit the amount of bandwidth we even use. So by limiting overdraw as much as we can, we're not loading data for pixels that we're not going to draw. And we can save a lot of energy that way. So Power VR is very proud of this architecture. And this might give them a heads up in a mobile area where their GPUs now are higher performance per watt, perhaps, because of this. We don't have exact data to prove that, but it's definitely a good concept to use. So yeah, after you do the tiles and the hidden surface remover, then finally you use your texture and shading process to do the pixel shading. And now you only are doing it on the fragments that will be appearing. So this is a block diagram of the Power VR SGX Series 5. And this is the GPU that's used in the iPhone 4S, the iPad 2, and the new iPad. So this thing here, the USSC2, this is your typical shader. And it's a unified shader architecture, so it's one like you would see in NVIDIA architectures. And then you can see like the tiling coprocessor split up into the different tiles, and the ISP over there to actually synthesize the tiles together. Okay, so summarizing this architecture, so like I said, it was used in the A5 and A5X. We have the unified shaders, which is different from the NVIDIA architectures, and this tile-based deferred rendering, which I think Patrick will talk about more. And I should mention this is what they call a multi-core architecture, and what I mean by that is that the different devices scale in the number of these Power VR chips that they use. So the iPad 2 uses a dual-core chip, and each core has 4 shaders, so you have 8 shaders on that device. The iPad 3, or the new iPad, uses 16 of these shaders instead, so theoretically double the performance. Any questions about the Power VR architecture or the NVIDIA architecture? Okay. So this is just a summary of all the different popular mobile GPU architectures that are out there. And the points to make out are there's a couple with unified shaders and then a couple still with separate pixel and vertex shaders. It hasn't gotten to the point yet, perhaps, for some of these companies where it's economical or perhaps feasible to do a unified shader architecture for their devices. But we'll definitely see this soon. You can also see the difference in the width. That should actually be VLIW instead of SIMD. And the different architectures. Almost all of these are immediate mode with early Z, so we try to cut out as many fragments as we can, but that's dependent on the order that we submit our primitives versus the tile-based deferred rendering where it doesn't matter and we can filter them all. So I want to talk a little bit about mobile trends. So one big thing we're seeing, especially in the tablet space, is higher screen resolutions. The new iPad is a big example of that, but also Android tablets in a few months will be having extreme resolutions, one that you'll usually see only on like a 21 or a 24-inch monitor. we also want longer battery life out of our devices, always. That's a demand of everybody. And people are also clamoring for higher quality mobile gaming. So if we keep in mind these three demands, let's look at perhaps the iPad. So the iPad has a screen resolution of 2048 by 1536 now. The previous iPad was 1024 by 768, which is what you'd see in like a 15-inch monitor maybe 10 years ago. So we're doubling the pixels on both the horizontal and the vertical components. So this is a total of 3.1 million pixels, and it's probably bigger than almost any monitor that you've ever used around in terms of pixel density. On the other hand, they still kept the battery life as just about equal, maybe a little lower than the previous versions of the iPad. And what do you think will happen to the gaming performance for a device like this when you're driving this many pixels? So you'd want to keep probably consistent, right? You know, performance is definitely going to drop when you're suddenly driving four times as many pixels as you used to, even if you increase the amount of resources that you have. So I thought this was kind of cool that Apple really boosted the GPU performance. One could even say that the GPU inside the iPad 2 was overkill. These benchmarks, I think, are limited by VSync, so that's why we're seeing a cap of 60 frames per second. But you can see that the third generation iPad can still hold its own when it's driving at its native resolution. This benchmark is admittedly a bit old, and there's really no mobile GPU benchmarks really out there, as opposed to the desktop scene. But you can see at least that it's possible that the iPad can hold its own at a resolution four times previous devices. I thought it was interesting too that for games like Infinity Blade, which is probably one of the more popular and very graphically intense games on iOS, what Epic Games does is they actually render the game at 1.4 times the resolution of the iPad 2, and then they use the device to upscale it all the way to the iPad 3 resolution. So it shows at least that they definitely didn't want to render their game at 2048 by 1536, but the architecture does give more room to at least even drive more pixels and remove some aliasing effects that way. So here's a die shot of the Apple A5X, which is the GPU the SoC that is used in the iPad, the new iPad. The A5 was the one that was used in the iPad 2 and iPhone 4S. And you can see some of the trade-offs that they're making these days. So in the top left, you can see the ARM cores. So this is a dual-core chip, so you see two cores up there at the top. Now compare that to the size of a pair of GPUs. You can already see that half the GPU space is already larger than the CPU, and we have double that. Another thing to point out is look at where the DDR memory interfaces are. Back in the day, they would be around the CPU because that used to be the more important thing. That's where you wanted to minimize latency, so you'd want to have shorter wires, and you want to have more bandwidth probably to your CPU, which is used more. But now we have four interfaces, and that's a big thing, four interfaces, not two or one, which are previous architectures, all sitting around the GPU. So you're seeing how much emphasis Apple is placing on GPU performance for devices like these. And it's especially interesting when you consider, say, that the NVIDIA Tegra actually only has one 32-bit memory interface, whereas Apple here, we're looking at potentially a 128-bit interface just to drive their GPUs. So it's odd that Apple instead of NVIDIA right now is the one really driving GPU performance in the mobile scene. We can see how much they really are. So this picture I got from Anatech is actually really interesting. And this is two scale comparisons of different dies. So this is the Tegra 2, and the A4 are roughly similar in die, and they're around the same generation parts, a year or so ago. This is the Tegra 3. The Apple A5 is already much larger because of GPU. And then see the A5X in comparison. And you can see how much Apple is willing to sacrifice area in order to get better performance out of the GPUs. And you can even note that in this second to last row here, where the Apple iPad A5X is actually larger than the dual-core Sandy Bridge inside of MacBook Air.
This kind of makes me wonder what Apple's yields on those things are.
Sorry?
That kind of makes me wonder what Apple's yields on the A5X are.
Mm-hmm. Like, especially, they didn't do a die shrink, so it's still a 45-nanometer chip. So I can't imagine. At least these chips are still in the small kind of range, as opposed to, like, this is a dual-core part. More Sandy Bridges are quad-cores, which are bigger and so forth. But still, yeah, it's a massive die, and they're definitely hurting in terms of that. Also, look at the battery size itself. I said before that the iPad tries to maintain the same battery life as the older one. The older iPad had a 25-watt-hour battery life, or battery capacity. The new one has 42.5. This is actually larger than the battery inside a laptop. So you can see the different things Apple is willing to do just to boost the screen resolution. And oddly enough, that's not something that everybody will really notice. They'll just say, oh, the screen looks sharper. But it's not like our laptops and desktops where everything becomes really tiny and crisp because we increase the resolution. UI components still stay the same in all these mobile devices because we need to touch them. So really, to make the screen sharper, they went through this much effort. And to make the device, they made the device a millimeter thicker, shoved a battery that was 60% larger, and made a die that's also much, much larger. So a massive engineering effort just to make the screen crisper. So you can see where mobile GPUs are going. Any questions about this? So last point I want to talk about is just what are different things that will happen in the immediate future. So these Power VR chips that I talked about are actually OpenCL capable, if you want to talk about compute. But you don't see an OpenCL driver on Android phones. So as a result, you're not going to be able to use OpenCL, at least at this moment, to do compute on your cell phone if you wanted to. I did see actually a master's thesis by someone where they tried to do this image processing algorithm through GLSL. And I don't know if Patrick mentioned this once, but that was the old way of doing a general purpose GPU, where you would just render a full screen quad, which is something you're going to do in homework 5, or it's been done for you really, just so you can have some vertices on the screen, and then load your input data from textures, and then write to the frame buffer and read the pixels back from that, and use your pixel shader as your compute workhorse. So that's what this guy was doing. So you can still do that at least, because you have GLSL. The next generation devices, though, will have Direct3D 11 support, which I think at least means that we're going to be able to use compute shaders. And so, especially since these devices are going to be running Windows 8, then hopefully we should have access to full direct compute and therefore actually be able to run computer algorithms on our smartphones and tablets. PowerVR had a press release a few months ago about the new Series 6 architecture where they're saying they'll have hundreds to thousands of gigaflops, which is harkening back to maybe GPUs of 4 or 5 years ago on the desktop side. Let's see how much they actually keep up with that, because like we said before, we have to keep in mind these bandwidth and energy constraints. We can shove a ton of shaders because area is not that precious these days, especially with transistor shrinking. But then how do we actually give the memory bandwidth to support these devices? And 2 weeks ago when Kepler came out, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang sent an email to the staff saying, thanks to our energy-efficient Kepler architecture, we can see this going everywhere from data centers to super phones. So the rumor mill just went crazy, and you see the post by Engadget everywhere else saying, oh, Kepler is coming to your smartphone. That probably isn't true, but we can definitely see elements of probably GPU design. Exactly. We'll definitely see elements of desktop GPU designs, especially at least unified shaders, coming very soon. I also thought it was cool, too, that NVIDIA codenames all of their Tegra chips with superheroes. So the last one was Kal-El for Superman. The next one is going to be Wayne. And after that, Logan is Stark. So we'll see what the different superheroes have to provide. That's it. Any questions for me? Okay, cool.